Welcome to the Brain Eater Podcast. This is my second podcast, and I promise you we have quite a number two in store for you today.
Death, be not proud, though some have called thee mighty and dreadful, for thou art not so.
You know, I could just end the review right here, and that would tell you everything you need to know about Grim Reaper, a 2007 direct-to-video flick directed by Michael Pfeiffer. Death has very little to be proud of here, and he's not alone. Pfeiffer had produced the movies Witchcraft, Parts 5 through 9 inclusive. You might think I could just end the review right here, and that would tell you everything you need to know about Grim Reaper, the 2007 direct-to-video flick. You'd be wrong. The Witchcraft series was full of nudity and softcore sex, which at least gave us something to watch to take our minds off the pain. Unfortunately, Grim Reaper has no such distractions. I don't think there have ever been many people who took the idea of a Grim Reaper literally, that is, considered him anything other than a symbol or an allegorical figure. But that's precisely what this movie wants us and its characters to believe, at least on some level, that there's an actual Grim Reaper out there who is the personification of death itself. Now, I don't think death is the sort of thing you can personify effectively. Death isn't really a thing at all. It's an absence, a loss, a void. It's null, it's less than nothing. How can you personify something that's less than nothing? I don't even think that death is part of the human experience. The consequences of death are, but even people who've died and been resuscitated later, in spite of their hallucinations about floating outside their bodies, have not experienced death. At the moment of death, there's no longer a you to have experienced anything. Now, how do you put a human face on something like that, even if that face is only a skull? Still, it's not difficult to see how the image of death as a reaper, a pale man with a scythe who harvests human lives, would catch on in the West. In the words of the Bible, "For all flesh is as grass, and the glory of man as the flower of the grass. The grass withereth, and the flower falleth away." Certainly at times like the Middle Ages, when the image of the Grim Reaper really burned itself into the Western imagination, times of plague and war and natural disaster, it must have seemed as though the grass was not merely withering and falling away, but being mown down by the acre. No, maybe I should just end the review right here. Let the quotations from John Donne, or the King James Bible, or Johannes Brahms' German Requiem, or maybe some other musical examples like Camille Saint-Saëns' Danse Macabre, or Franz Liszt's Totentanz, as two pieces meant to depict in music the Grim Reaper himself. Let these examples suffice to tell you everything you need to know about the colossal failure of the human imagination, which is Grim Reaper, 2007 direct-to-video flick, directed by Michael Pfeiffer. I mean, look, even in a medium as literal as film, we've seen death pack his bags, whistle a blues, ride a horse and take a holiday. We've seen him play chess with a weary knight. We've seen him play Twister with a couple of boneheads. But we've never yet, as far as I can remember, seen him as a mute, lumbering, slow-witted serial killer in the Jason Voorhees mold. Until now. So what follows contains spoilers, if you can truly spoil something that smells so bad coming out of the box. Our heroine is Rachel, a stripper of the Lindsay Lohan I know who killed me kind. She never actually takes off any of her clothes, yet still manages to keep her job, if not the audience's interest. This is just the sort of thankless role in the sort of ridiculous movie that cries out for some gratuitous nudity. But this is all part of a distressing trend we've seen in recent exploitation horror. Movies where the only boobs on display are the characters themselves. Anyway, Rachel comes down and does her little act around the pole, dressed as an angel, and the only thing she manages to take off are her feathery angel wings. And here we have our first moment of true horror in the picture. We realize the movie thinks this means something. Now, Rachel finishes her dance and goes to leave for the evening, walking out into the deserted back alley behind the strip club, when she is clobbered by a speeding taxi. This is apparently the moment in which both Rachel and the driver of the out-of-control taxi are supposed to have been killed. But in the event, they aren't even particularly hurt. Rachel, in fact, becomes less and less hurt as the night goes on and as her situation gets worse. The two of them get taken to a strange and strangely deserted hospital. The cabbie, who you'll be unsurprised to learn is of non-specific West Asian descent, claims that something is badly wrong and that some shadowy shape is coming after him. He's dragged off hysterical to another part of the hospital while Rachel goes to be examined by a peculiarly hostile nurse. When Rachel is left alone for a moment, she goes looking for the cabbie. She sees him being skewered by a robed figure carrying a scythe. Of course, when she panics and tries to tell someone about it, it simply turns out that the poor guy didn't make it. It's just an inexplicable sudden death, no grim reapers wielding farm implements. By this point, I thought I knew how the movie was going to play out. I was wrong, but if I'd been correct, I probably wouldn't have been quite as upset with the film as I became. This is what I thought was going to happen. And by the way, if there are any independent filmmakers right now reaching for their pencils and paper, let me warn you, don't. This wouldn't have made a very good movie either. Now, I'd read that some medical professionals have difficulty being patients themselves, especially when a serious illness is involved. By the time we were introduced to the chain-smoking doctor who's the obvious villain of the piece, I figured this hospital must be a fake hospital, run by a group of doctors who, after a career of wielding godlike powers of life and death over their patients, had found themselves terminally ill. To recapture their feelings of omnipotence, they would stage accidents involving healthy young people of whom they'd become insanely jealous, and they'd bring them to this fake hospital. Then they'd take turns putting on the Grim Reaper suit to torment the young people and eventually kill them. But that's not what we get. It's going to turn out that this is the actual Grim Reaper, ladies and gentlemen, though I suppose he's not so much death itself as death's slightly incompetent henchman. When death screws up, it's the Grim Reaper's job to come and clean up the mess. The evil chain-smoking doctor has some sort of plan to collect a whole group of people who have had near-death experiences together in one place, and then wait for the Grim Reaper to come for them. A couple of things suggest themselves here. First of all, it's nice to see that the Grim Reaper is a little like the rest of us. He waits until his inbox is full to overflowing before he actually does anything. But what I really want to complain about is something I've noticed in other movies as well. We know that alchemists and mad scientists and other seekers after arcane knowledge can spend their whole lifetimes, even several artificially extended lifetimes, trying to discover the secrets of life and death. And they often do this by, say, piecing together poorly preserved fragments of books, like the Necronomicon, all of those fragments of which have been translated none too accurately into languages and alphabets that nobody knows anymore, and that's a very difficult thing to do. Yet, any time a bunch of particularly ignorant young people is put into a library, they always manage to find the one book, and the one page in the one book, and the one paragraph in the one page in the one book, that tells them everything they need to know, everything the evil guy has been working his life to figure out, and it's always written in plain, modern English. And that brings me to my next question, which is simply, how does someone actually make an arrangement like this with death? Advertise on Craigslist? Is there a hotline or something you call? 1-800-MR-DEATH? Actually, no, I tried that one. It turns out to be the number for a credit union in Indiana. Sorry, guys. Anyway,
This mad doctor has reached an agreement with death somehow, and now the arrival of this one belly-shirted exotic dancer has tipped the balance of death's mistake and called forth the Grim Reaper to claim all their lives. So now, Rachel and the other people who've had near-death experiences must flee for their lives through the darkened corridors of an abandoned mental hospital. And it's not easy, because the Grim Reaper can teleport himself into locked rooms and emerge from the shadows any time he wants. As long as he's not actually chasing Rachel. And then he skewers and slices his victims with his scythe. Of course, if this is the sort of thing the Grim Reaper does regularly, I wonder why more unexplained deaths aren't the result of scythe wounds. But hey, there I go trying to make sense of this again. Now, when it's Rachel that's being chased, the rules change. Suddenly, the Grim Reaper gets all stupid and slow and lumbering. Rachel even runs into a darkened room, a dead end, and hides behind some boxes. And the Grim Reaper goes up to the room, looks in the doorway, and then walks away again without even searching. So much for the Avatar of Death. Then again, we've also found out that he's allergic to light. The Avatar of Death doesn't even like dim light, as though something so paltry has ever stopped death at any point in history. But while we're on the subject of chasing Rachel, while all this has been going on, her medical student boyfriend has been searching the city for her. He's been putting together improbable clues and getting advice from some guy who might even be an angel or something equally lazy from a screenwriting point of view. The whole point of his being a medical student comes into play when he finally reaches Rachel, and by finally, I mean finally as in final girl finally. Rachel has come up with a brilliant plan at the last possible moment to defeat the Grim Reaper, and it involves her boyfriend being a med student. And in order to describe how staggeringly, mind-meltingly stupid this big idea is, I'm going to have to take a moment to collect myself. When I was in high school, I knew a guy named Abed. He was a few years ahead of me, and he was one of the nicest people you ever hope to meet. And he was no fool, but there was some kind of disconnect between his brain and his tongue. For example, one day he got in a big argument with another kid, and that kid said he was going to kill him. He was just going to kill him. And in the heat of the moment, Abed said, "Yeah? Well, the day you kill me is the day I die." And that became the ultimate Abedism right there. I bring this up because I never in my wildest imaginings ever dreamed this would become the basis for a screenplay. That's right, Rachel's big plan is to avoid the Grim Reaper, the Avatar of Death, whose sole purpose is to kill her by dying, by having her boyfriend temporarily stop her heart. She wants to avoid death by dying. Now, she asks her boyfriend how long the brain can go without oxygen, and he says the outer limit is about 7 minutes. So she tells him to stop her heart and leave her dead for a full 7 minutes. This is to give her 7 minutes in the world of the dead, or some such nonsense, where she can fight the Grim Reaper and get her life back, maybe. I have some issues with this. Actually, I have a whole long laundry list of issues, but let's just confine ourselves for now to the idea of staying temporarily dead for 7 minutes. I wouldn't want to do it. It reminds me of a variation on the old joke that got Ronald Reagan in so much trouble when he told it near an open microphone. See, there's this mad scientist, and he wants to find out how long the brain can go without oxygen before irreversible brain damage occurs. So he gets a hold of a victim, and he stops his heart for 3 minutes. When he revives the victim, he's a little confused, a little uncoordinated, but otherwise he seems okay. So the mad scientist gets another victim and kills him for 5 minutes. This time, the victim shows definite signs of brain damage. So the mad scientist gets another victim and kills him for a whole 7 minutes. And when he brings him back, severe brain damage has occurred. And just as he's about to toss the unresponsive body into the alligator pit, the brain-dead victim sits up and starts writing the script for Grim Reaper, a 2007 direct-to-video flick directed by Michael Pfeiffer. Okay, so that wasn't very funny. But neither is this. Rachel's plan works. Once she's dead, by strange coincidence, she finds herself reliving the last moments before the accident that was supposed to have killed her. Why? I don't know. Apparently that's how death works. Who knew? So she finds herself out in the alley, And she hears the taxi speeding toward her, and this time she turns around and she sees the Grim Reaper, and she confronts him, and she stands face to face with him, looking up into his lack of eyes as the taxi comes barreling toward her. And then, at the last possible moment, just as she's about to get clobbered by the cab, she puts part two of her ingenious plan into effect. She steps out of the way. Yeah. So the cab runs over the Grim Reaper, leaving him a pile of rags on the ground. Oh, but don't worry, that's not the end of it. See, the evil doctor is back in the real world, tussling with the boyfriend and edging him ever closer to that 7-minute deadline. So Rachel finds herself in Death's own mausoleum, and she's being stalked by the now robeless Grim Reaper. It turns out the Grim Reaper, under all his robes, looks something like the portly mummy from Dave Dakota's Ancient Evil. Talk about a movie you don't want to be compared to, favorably or unfavorably. So anyway, just as the Grim Reaper is about to finally claim Rachel, her boyfriend revives her in the nick of time, the sun starts coming up in the land of the dead, and wouldn't you know it, the sunrise defeats the Grim Reaper, who turns into dust or something. It's not often that I spoil a movie as completely as I have this one. I have two reasons for doing it. One is I really, really detest this movie, and I don't want you to have any reason to feel like you need to see it. The other reason is so I can reveal to you the final plot twist, the movie's one and only concession to reality. See, after all she's been through, having had the accident, being knocked unconscious with sedatives, being chased through a hospital by no less than the physical embodiment of death, seeing people die all around her, and finally being killed for 7 minutes, Rachel does what every movie heroine does these days. She gets up as though nothing's happened and goes on with her life. Except, in this case at least, although this in no way makes up for the rest of the film, Rachel actually drops dead in the last seconds of the movie. Plop. The end. Ugh. I started assembling material for this podcast in early 2008, a few months after the death of my father. I'm finishing it in the spring of 2011, a few weeks after the death of my dog. Time passes, and just as I begin to heal, something random comes up to remind me of the utter failure which is this movie. And I begin to get mad. I think about the great advancements in civilization, in art, and music, and literature, science, philosophy, religion, how they've been won in the face of death. I think of the tragic, heroic struggle we all have to face, the struggle to make sense of our lives and come to terms with our mortality, to understand the finality of death, and still go on. And then there's this crappy, crappy movie. So I've got an idea. If you've ever had any inclination to see this movie, or worse, if this podcast has given you the perverse idea you should track it down and watch it, why not take a roughly equal amount of time and do something you won't regret later? Specifically, I can suggest you go to www.braineater.com/Brahms, where you'll find the complete recording of the German Requiem performed by the Holden Consort under Paul Mattel that I used an excerpt from to open this podcast. It's available under the Creative Commons license, as is this podcast. And trust me, it's a far better use of 70 minutes of your life.